Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And Jim, we've got some doozies in all three of these categories. No reaching for topics today, that's for sure. The lead, the good martini, this is CNBC. President Donald Trump has canceled his historic summit in Singapore with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un that was scheduled for next month. The meeting, which would have marked the first face-to-face encounter between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader, was set for June 12th. Trump sent a letter to Kim. He says, "We appreciate your time, patience, and effort with respect to our recent negotiations." He also said that he was looking forward to meeting with Kim, but he feels it is inappropriate at this time to have this long-planned meeting because of the tremendous anger and open hostility displayed in your most recent statement. So he did go on to thank Kim for releasing the hostages and hopes that there will be a meeting at some time. Jim, I have to assume he's talking to the statements from the North Koreans in connection with those joint military exercises we had with the South Koreans, suggesting there were a planned invasion, and their reaction to the John Bolton comments that this could be shades of Libya and so forth. My assumption is that Trump thought it looked better for us to cancel the summit than for Kim to do it at the last second. But in the end, a lot of people were worried, of course, that Kim Jong-un was just doing this for the photo op and really had no intention to change much. We'll see if that's true going forward here. But what do you make of Trump's decision?
It would have been nice if the summit had gone forward and they'd actually reached a serious agreement that had led towards the denuclearization of North Korea. But if you subscribe to the approach and kind of the viewpoint of Robert Kelly, this is the professor over in South Korea. You may remember him from the BBC interview where his whole family ended up walking in the middle of it. He is an expert on North Korea. He's actually critical of the current leadership of South Korea, thinking that they are a little too eager to talk and a little too eager to make concessions to North Korea in exchange for promises. But he had been very critical of the Trump administration and Trump himself and saying, look, you don't just accept this after 45 minutes of consideration and fail to tell the rest of your cabinet, much less fail to tell South Korea. That he felt like this was Trump flying by the seat of his pants. I think everyone would kind of recognize that Trump is not extraordinarily well-versed in the details of North Korea policy. He had done this when he was changing his Secretary of State, changing his National Security Advisor. And he foresaw disaster, if for no other reason than the idea that Trump was suddenly becoming very much invested in having the summit and already starting, as he said, starting to take the victory lap. You saw the president joking about how people said he should deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. And everybody's like, whoa, guys, we haven't had the summit yet. The hard work hasn't been done yet. You know, if it leads to that, terrific. And if you happen to lead to denuclearization in North Korea, then yes, God bless you. And you do deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. But we're not there yet. And there was a long history of North Korea promising to do something and then not living up to the promises. And if you had this nagging feeling that Trump could get taken, that he could end up making more concessions in exchange for promises, the South Koreans had already dropped out of military exercises that were angering the North Koreans. Well, the danger about being North Korea and engaging in your usual habits of furious language every time somebody in the administration says something you don't like and threatening to walk away from the table is that if you give Trump an off-ramp, he may just take it. That's what happened here. And now we don't have to worry about Trump getting taken at the negotiating table because he just walked away from the negotiating table. And it sounds like from reporters who were in North Korea to cover the televised detonation of their nuclear test facility. A couple of people are pointing out that, like, it's great that they're doing this and they're showing it to the media, but they're not showing it to international inspectors, making you wonder if the facility really is as permanently destroyed as the North Koreans are claiming it is. Look, North Koreans seem just shocked by this. And it seems there's something a little bit delicious about giving them a taste of their own medicine. Look, if negotiations could have worked out, that would have been terrific. But there is, you know, increasing signs in the last couple of days that this was North Korea up to the usual tricks of you know, being nice with one hand and then reversing course a couple of days ago, hoping it can force concessions out of the other side. And for, you know, all of Trump's flaws and this nagging feeling that he's doing all this based on gut instinct and flying by the seat of his pants and he doesn't really have much of a plan, maybe his impulsiveness is serving him well here. It's also worth noting that in the Wall Street Journal, a couple other sources, there were reports that Trump was getting a little bit nervous about this summit, that there was, he did have nagging sense that this was that perhaps North Korea thought they were going to try to pull one over on him. He began to grasp the high stakes of it. I noticed that the White House started marketing the challenge coins that would go with the summit. I bet you can get them on eBay. They're either going to be those, the Tampa Bay Lightning Stanley Cup Finals t-shirts that were not worn last night. Or who knows? Maybe North Korea will suddenly take a very different approach and start making more concessions. It is kind of interesting that we've gotten them to destroy their nuclear facilities, the three hostages returned, and a couple of material concessions that Trump has just pocketed and walked away from the table. We'll see how this shakes out. But, again, it's kind of tough to get taken to the cleaners in negotiations if you don't partake in the negotiations, huh, Greg?
That's true. And the max pressure campaign continues. There's a lot of evidence that North Korea is quickly running out of money. China is cooperating more than it has in some ways when it comes to North Korea. So they're feeling the financial pinch. So maybe that will make them even more desperate to behave. And I do wonder if we had some intelligence that North Korea wasn't quite destroying, like you were saying, what they claim they were destroying, and perhaps that was the last straw for Trump. You mentioned Robert Kelly, the expert, and he's most famous for his kids walking in on him during an international television broadcast. He does that pretty often, usually with the door locked now, I'm sure. But one guy on Twitter yesterday said, "Dude, you have to rearrange your office. I can't pay attention to anything you say because I'm just looking at the door." So.
Absolutely. It's now one of those things where, at the end of every segment, when he finishes his points, one, it'd be fascinating to see how many people were actually paying attention to what he was saying and how many people were just watching the door the whole time waiting for a surprise visitor. And two, just a sense of, that slight sense of letdown. You can almost hear it in the anchor's voice. "Professor Robert Kelly from South Korea, thank you very much."
Oh, man, that was great. If you haven't seen it, please YouTube it. It's worth it. All right, let's move on to the bad martini now. And let's talk about Trump's instincts on another issue. Yesterday, as most people know, the owners of the National Football League came together in agreement on a policy to deal with kneeling. And that issue came up as Brian Kilmeade of Fox and Friends on the Fox News Channel spoke with President Trump. I assume this was recorded yesterday since it was the first Trump was hearing about the policy. Here's the interaction.
"The owners have voted unanimously to approve a new national anthem rule that says if you're not going to stand, stay in the locker room. If you go to the field, you have to stand. If you have a protest, your team's going to get fined. This is the first time you're hearing this. What's your reaction, Mr. President?"
"Well, I think that's good. I don't think people should be staying in locker rooms, but still, I think it's good. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. Well, you shouldn't be playing. You shouldn't be there. Maybe you shouldn't be in the country. You have to stand proudly for the national anthem. And the NFL owners did the right thing if that's what they've done."
Jim, we have talked about this issue probably ad nauseum to some folks, but we have very much agreed that the anthem is not the place to lodge the protest. But when Trump goes to this level saying if you do protest it, which is a First Amendment right, as unpopular as it might be for us and others, that you shouldn't be in the country anymore. It's one thing to say that a private employer can do something about it. To say you shouldn't be in the country is absurd.
Where does he want them to go? Right? It's not like they're illegal immigrants. It's not like they're, these are people who are Americans, pretty much as far as I know of all the players. They're born here, spent their whole lives here. Look, lots of us have criticisms of this country. You are a bad martini. Usually most days is a criticism of somebody in this country. And there are a lot, I don't think you have to be a crazy left winger to look at your country and say, you know what? It's not living up to its values in certain ways. It's frustrating. Now, I actually am not that thrilled with this NFL policy. I think it's actually going to pour gasoline onto a fire. And I say this not liking when players kneel one bit. I think Colin Kaepernick's understanding of this issue is infuriating. I don't really understand how you can, denounce police brutality in America while wearing a Fidel Castro t-shirt. One of the things that's been frustrating since the moment this debate began, the NFL players, whether you love them, hate them, love football, hate football, they're convinced that this is the best way they can to call attention to an issue that really bothers them and really upsets them. And if you don't believe that this is an issue that affects the lives of young African-American men, including those involved in professional athletics, there's a video of the Milwaukee Police Department, I think, you people should take a look at, that basically this guy who has a parking infraction ended up with this Milwaukee Bucks rookie getting tased by the end of it. 8 cops involved, half dozen cop cars involved. all over a parking infraction. The nagging feeling that, in fact, excessive force might not be a all too rare circumstance. Again, these guys think they're doing the right thing. And I've always kind of wished they were a little more less than denunciation than a probing. Okay, NFL players, what would you want to see to make you feel like, okay, I feel like the issue has been addressed, the issue has been resolved, and I'm going to stand for the flag because I feel like the country is attempting to live up to its values now? Is it body cameras on every cop? Is it prosecution of police misconduct? Is it protest? What do you guys want to see to make you feel like it? Now, here's the thing. I don't think the national anthem is the right venue for protest. I don't think when you're standing, you're saying the country is perfect or the country has no problems or there's nothing that worries you or upsets you or bothers you or angers you about your country. You're standing for your country because, one, you're proud of it, but two, also, we're blessed to be here. We are lucky to be here. And I think that's what really sticks in the craw of the angry fans, is this, I would argue, unintended, but I think palpable sense of ingratitude. Look, you know, NFL players, and many of you are multimillionaires. You get paid very well to play a game. You live a life that millions of people can only dream of. You may not intend to say, I don't appreciate this country, but taking the knee is giving that message to people. You're not holding up a sign. It's not specific. The act of kneeling can be interpreted by any way you want, and it's not clear enough. And what it basically says is, everybody else in this stadium is standing. I will not. And it's kind of an implicit criticism of everybody else who's standing. So my suspicion is that this policy by the NFL is just going to spur more of them. Because I don't know about you, Greg. My suspicion is that players aren't going to care if the team gets fined if they take a knee. Also, for what's worth noting, Chris Johnson, by the way, brother of Woody Johnson, former full-time owner of the Jets and now the current U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom, Chris Johnson said he will pay the fine for any Jet player who takes the knee. Now, the great irony is last year, no Jets player took a knee or did other protests during the national anthem. But he seems to, you know, it's interesting. This was unanimously approved by the owners, but at the same time, certain owners very much want to make sure that the players know that they stand with them. I'd feel better if we were addressing the heart of the issue that is driving the protests rather than trying to clamp down on the protests and Trump going further by saying, you don't belong in this country. Look, the one week you had more than 200 players taking the knee or protesting or making other gestures was the week after Trump called them sons of bitches. It's like each side is poking at each other with sticks and heightening anger and frustration and confrontation instead of saying, okay, how do we address the problem that's actually getting people upset here?
Well, we'll see where it goes from here. The union wasn't even too happy with the owners for the decision. I'm sure they're not going to like this too much either. So, like you said, gasoline on the fire. We were kind of hoping it would peter out by the start of the next season, but we'll see. We'll see. Let's move on to the crazy martini now, Jim. And I know you're excited. James Clapper has a new book out, so he's making the rounds on the media. It's called Facts and Fears. James Clapper's talking about facts. That's interesting. But he's on PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. First of all, talking about why spying and informants are very different things. But then Judy Woodruff asks him about a claim that I guess he made in the book, but maybe he's made elsewhere as well, that he believes that Russian meddling in the 2016 campaign actually made the difference in the outcome. And here's his explanation.
First, I need to make clear that when we did our formal intelligence community assessment in January of 2017, we did not make any call at all about whether the Russians affected the outcome of the election. We didn't have the authority, charter, or capability to do that. Since I left the government, though, as a private citizen, it's what I would call my informed opinion that given the massive effort the Russians made and the number of citizens that they touched and the variety and the multidimensional aspects of what they did to influence opinion and affect the election, and given the fact that it turned on less than 80,000 votes in three states, to me it just exceeds logic and credulity that they didn't affect the election, and it's my belief they actually turned it.
You got to love Jim Clapper. We concluded definitively that the Russians didn't impact the outcome of the election. But after leaving office, I thought about it some more. And yeah, I think they did now.
These would be the caricatures of muscular Bernie Sanders that did it. Is that right? That was it. And Hillary in a boxing ring with Satan. That's the these are the Facebook ads that touched. So I love how he says touched, like it's, you know, Morgan Freeman or something. To use a very up to the moment, perhaps tasteless joke there. I guess the idea here is that Facebook ads have mind control. That if you see a Facebook ad by the, which was all these ads that I've seen, by the way, struck me as being very clumsy and ham-handed. And you could tell someone who was not all that familiar with American culture was it, you know, this was the typical Russian intelligence operatives idea of the kind of message that would persuade Americans, not the actual ones that I think there's a certain amount of condescension in the Clapper assessment of like, look, I wouldn't be persuaded by this stuff, but you know, those Hicks in those Rust Belt states, those guys, they'll fall for anything. And clearly, if it had not been for those Russian influences, they would have made the logical, smart choice and voted for Hillary Clinton instead of voting for the president who I can't stand. Look, it's, you know, at the heart of it, I mean, this is what this debate really has gotten down to, is this nagging sense that people who believe the 2016 election can't have happened the way that it did. It can't be fair and square. It, you know, it is a historical accident that the world has been turned upside down and they have to change it. The best way to change it is to basically say some variation of, well, it shouldn't count because Trump cheated, because Trump either colluded with the Russians or the Russian influence was so pervasive and so powerful and so overwhelming that those knuckle-dragging Americans in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin couldn't possibly have actually wanted to vote the way they did. Clearly, they were hypnotized by these unbelievably persuasive ads on Facebook, and that's what did it. And it can't possibly represent that the American people looked at Hillary Clinton after 8 years of Barack Obama and looked at Hillary Clinton and said, now I'll roll my dice on the other guy. It's really, really infuriating, and I think also probably kind of fairly revealing. When Clapper says all this, I would say, look, it's not like he's under oath. We've already seen the Clapper will say things that aren't true under oath. So it doesn't really matter there, does it, Greg?
No, it doesn't. And I go back to one of the first points you made. Count on your fingers the number of times you have radically changed a political position because of a social media post from someone else.
A little bit of credit on that score, though, Greg. I mean, on Facebook, you do look at it and you do say, wow, that person who I thought was hot in high school turned out to be really fat. So Facebook can change your minds about people, just not in terms of the elections. Of course, a lot of people are like, but really, how many people have looked at Jim's recent pictures and thought that? Good thing it's Friday, right, Greg?
Almost. One more day. One more dawn. One day more. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.